I believe that Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he, she, it, them, is, or was first and foremost a strategist of the cypherpunk traditions. This is extremely important because we need to understand the motivational ideology was not one of any sort of state capitalist nature or idiotic wealth fantasies of Lambos and other childish bullshit, but an explicit crypto-anarchist one. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I'm Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read a thing or two about Bitcoin more than anybody else you know, as a matter of fact. And we are going to get into a piece that will help push back a little bit against yesterday's pessimism. And this is a true cypherpunk form of thinking about this. I really love this perspective, and also got to thank Corey Clipston, CEO of Swan Bitcoin, for bringing this one to my attention. I had not bumped into it, and it is great. And also to Phil for kind of constantly pushing me to get this done. But as we get into this piece, I want you to think about this on a scale of about 30 years worth of thinking. So this was, this has very much been the cypherpunk vision of what cryptography does since the early to late 80s, and how its role and the role of the internet could potentially play out in the future. And this is what they've been building toward. And I got to give a shout out to The Reason, a four-part series that has just dropped. I think still only the first part is out, and I watched it immediately by, I think it's Jim Epstein, who put this one together. It's called Cypherpunks Write Code. I will have the link to it so that you can explore a little bit deeper. But this is one of those pieces that just really hits kind of the core of what cryptography is from a perspective of the philosophy and the dynamics of power between the individual and the state. And I love getting cosmic with this stuff, and this is going to be a great one to dig into. Real quick, shout out to Hexa Wallet for supporting Bitcoin Audible. And they actually just dropped a really cool new feature to their wallet, actually, that you can create a donation address, or excuse me, a donation wallet. And so I immediately jumped on it and am actually testing it out. There's a web front end so that you can just go and donate to my wallet, to Guy Swan, and it generates a new address essentially for everyone who goes to it, and does so in a clever little trick that they laid out in a Medium article announcing this. So I'll link to that if you want to check it out. And if you want to see what it looks like, go to guyswan.com/donate, and that is what it looks like to have a Hexa wallet donation wallet. So that's just something cool to announce, and again, thank you to Hexa Wallet for supporting the podcast. So let's not waste any more time and get into today's fascinating article titled Crypto, Truth, and Power. And this is from Eric Kaysen, by the way, who we have read his work before, and it is from the same website as the last fascinating piece we read of his, cryptosovereignty.org. And just to warn you before getting into it, this is some next-level crypto-anarchist going cosmic right here, but it's a really, really fun one. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump right in. Crypto, Truth, and Power. Understanding cryptography through Foucault's Biopower and the Paradigm of Total War. I want to start from the hypothesis that Bitcoin and crypto assets are explicit military assets of war. The military value of crypto assets and their non-physical nature of comes a priori to their economic value. By focusing on the military value of crypto assets from a topology of total war, the true economic value of crypto assets presents themselves. I believe that Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he, she, it, them, is, or was first and foremost a strategist of the cypherpunk traditions. This is extremely important because we need to understand the motivational ideology was not one of any sort of state capitalist nature or idiotic wealth fantasies of Lambos and other childish bullshit, but an explicit crypto-anarchist one. If we follow the historic trajectory of the development of cryptography, we come to find that its development was for both economic and military purposes. But it was only in the 20th century that it became a preeminent and singular objective of total war. It is important to point out that not only the development of the atomic bomb could be said to be more important than the development of computers for crypto analysis during World War II. Crypto is a technology of war first and foremost, which compelled the development of computers. We must always keep in mind. By understanding crypto as a munition of war, and as bulkword for the tactical organization of all things under the banner of assured privacy, we start to see the real power of crypto is not that of economics, but of war. When we start to investigate the very power-knowledge relationship which cryptography engages within, we understand the kind of Athenian form of power crypto is to counter the brutishness of a statist Ares violence. It is this very relationship that also allows for us to uncover what the codification of law is in our society, as pointed out by Foucault. Quote, "The state consists in the codification of a whole number of power relations, which render its functioning possible. And that revolution is a different type of codification of the same relations." Michel Foucault, Truth and Power. Through deconstructing the relationships between power, law, and cryptography through the lens of Foucault's biopower, we can come to understand how crypto systems create a total new form of social, economic, and ultimately political power through the literal codification of these same relations of power into crypto systems. Through this, crypto systems accomplish a twofold political task of both creating a mode of counterpower to whatever state apparatus it may be countering, state money, state identity, commercial activity, education, etc., while at the same time is creating a new crypto solution to these modes of subjugation and ultimately the law itself. This whole superstructure has been called the CypherNet. What the CypherNet does is replace the authority that guarantees law, which always constitutes with violence, with a system of truth that cannot profane itself, nor use violence to enforce its actions. Through exploring the relationship of the supremacy of blockchain truth-bearing capacity over state authoritarianism, and the majesty of mutual agreement to build power consensually through crypto alliances over the subjugating violence of sovereign state law, we can start to understand the novel new form of power that the CypherNet is constituting. Let us postulate the question of power as Foucault did in order to have a more succinct understanding of what is at stake in power. Quote, "Isn't power simply a form of warlike domination? Shouldn't one therefore conceive all problems of power in terms of relations of war? Isn't power a sort of generalized war, which assumes at particular moments the forms of peace and the state? Peace would then be a form of war, and the state a means of waging it." Perhaps Satoshi, in understanding the statement above, understood that in order for him to create a new form of money, which is a form of social contract, he first had to be entirely outside of the grasp of any state power. Satoshi knew that if he were to commit the greatest crime that had ever been committed, the final crime, which both abolishes old money and society, while constituting the new as well, there is no doubt that he would be branded an eternal enemy of any and all states. Thus, Satoshi knew he must have perfect forward secrecy, as homo sacer, to ensure that the violence which can always find a particular person through nationalistic identification of the flesh would never be able to unveil him. Thus, as the final criminal, he is also the first citizen of the new agreement of money that constituted the bloom of the CipherNet and the hope of a liberated technological future. By first absconding beyond the physical realm into homogenized bits, Satoshi purified himself from the capacity of being branded in the flesh and compromised through physical identification. By transmogrifying into the nameless, formless other, Levinas's stranger, which I nor anyone else can have no power over, Satoshi was the first to colonize this new territory of freedom with a new kind of social contract. This contract, which is the Bitcoin blockchain, is the first contract which constitutes the CipherNet. This contract not only created a new form of money, but a new kind of political and social structure as well. This form of political and social is based upon the irrevocable power of truth that must be barred in order for the blockchain to operate. The greatest and deepest of ironies is that crypto was never supposed to be an offensive weapon of war. That only became possible in a world completely captured by totalitarian state capitalism. Only in a world in which all governments rule from the mantra auctoritas non veritas facit legem, authority, not truth, makes legitimacy, does the power of truth become revolutionary. Only in a world where states regard themselves as gods who are not accountable to truth would they be able to create fiat money. And only in a world where they regard themselves as gods with the sole right to violence and excuse themselves from truth of their own monstrous injustices could we understand how they create their monopoly money. It is not majesty, nor grandeur, nor even law that allows for them to rule, but raw, barbaric violence that grows from the barrel of a gun and the edge of a knife. This is why the blockchain is so revolutionary. Not because it's a new kind of money, but because it is a new form of social contract that is found only in the CipherNet. It is only from the power of truth-bearing that is demanded of the blockchain that allows for it to issue a new kind of money. The power of the blockchain is found within this new social contract that is guaranteed and consummated through the CipherNet, which totally coincides with the code and the real economic value that it creates. The blockchain has revealed itself to be the Columbus's egg of truth, the manifest destiny of the information age, and quite possibly even the true face of capitalism in its final form. Perhaps only in this final state of capitalism was it even possible for a form of capital so radically liberated from any state power that it cannot even find a real identity to which find foothold to exert power from. This allows for the game of total war that is state capitalism to play itself out within the full theater offered to it, which not only captures the life of all people, but all economic and political institutions as well. It is this later fact that is exploited to create an economic machine of truth so powerful that it acts as a weapon of war against state capitalism. As these facts become known to all, just as the wealth of the New World presented a solution to the misery of European monarchism, crypto too will reveal its provincial nature in the course of time to be the answer to state capitalism and all of its hideous appendages of death, enslavement, and emptiness. Now that we understand what is at stake in the CipherNet and the kind of power it affords us, We can use Foucault's presentation of the cracks in the state's power via law in the following passage to guide our strategy against the state. Quote, to pose the problem in terms of the state means to continue posing it in terms of sovereign and sovereignty, that is to say, in terms of law. If one describes all these phenomena of power as independent on the state apparatus, this means grasping them as essentially repressive, the army as a power of deaths, police and justice as punitive instances, etc. I don't want to say that the state isn't important. What I want to say is that relations of power, and hence the analysis that must be made of them, necessarily extend beyond the limits of the state, in two senses. First of all, because the state, for all the omnipotence of its apparatuses, is far from being able to occupy the whole field of actual power relations. And further, because the state can only operate on the basis of other, already existing power relations. The state is superstructural in relation to a whole series of power networks that invest the body, sexuality, the family, kinship, knowledge, technology, and so forth. True, these networks stand in a conditioning-conditioned relationship to a kind of metapower, which is structured essentially around a certain number of great prohibition functions. But this metapower, with its prohibitions, can only take hold and secure its footing where it is rooted in a whole series of multiple and indefinite power relations that supply the necessary basis for the great negative forms of power. Crypto absconds from these great negative forms of power by blinding power from the start. Power cannot be created in the ciphernet through violence or subjection, but only through consensual agreement with the other. By removing one's physical body from the economic space first, by blinding in the ciphernet, the possibility of violence is banished. By removing one's identity from the agreement, none of the current relations of legal power can find their footing, nor the violence that would ultimately enforce such legal power can exist. At each instance that a form of subjugation can find its footing, it is first done through identification. Crypto blinds that form of power, while at the same time constituting an alternative through the ciphernet. This is the revolution Foucault spoke of, which is a different type of codification of the same relations of power which the state has monopolized under the guise of law through violence. Statism is the codification of law through authority, which finds its power in violence. The ciphernet is the codification of law based upon mutual agreement about truth verified through crypto, rather than authority based upon law. This was my point in The New Social Contract of Crypto. Crypto inverts Hobbes's dictum of sovereign power. Auctoritas non veritas facit legem. Authority, not truth, makes legitimacy. In De Siva. In 2. Veritas non auctoritas facit legem. Truth, not authority, makes legitimacy. Truth is a thing of this world. It is produced only by virtue of multiple forms of constraint, and it induces regular effects of power. Each society has its regime of truth, its general polities of truth. That is, the types of discourse which it accepts and makes function as true, the mechanisms and instances which enable one to distinguish true and false statements, the means by which each is sanctioned, the techniques and procedures accorded value in the acquisition of truth, and the status of those who are charged with saying what counts as true. By using crypto as sophisticated mimetic tool to act as strategic bulwarks against all statist imperialist apparatuses and all of their obtuse truths from which they create power, the ciphernet is the citadel of freedom from which new forms of truth can be produced and circulated. It is through this production that we are building the future means from which our form of politics will be born. Quote, "One day humanity will play with law just as children play with disused objects, not in order to restore them to their canonical use, but to free them from it for good." Giorgio Agamben, State of Exception. The possibility to free ourselves from the insanity that we call statism and law has arrived. However, it will vanish as quickly as it came if we do not make a concerted effort to continue the political development our cause needs. This power found in crypto not only has the possibility to throw off the yoke of state imperialism and the growing shadow of technological fascism, but that of creating a totally new form of political activity that is free from the ensnarements and traps of past political systems that are long overdue for death. The political question, to sum up, is not error, illusion, alienated consciousness, or ideology, but is truth itself. Hence the importance of Nietzsche and to kill your gods of state and abandon your masters of capital. Ooh, I told you this one got cosmic. So there is a lot of really fascinating stuff in this about, it's very similar in kind of the theme of the last piece that we read from Crypto Sovereignty about the idea of replacing authority with truth, and that this is like a fundamental element of cryptography. This is what cryptography does. I really want to get into the whole codification of a new law and talk about that. Hopefully my French accent did okay with Foucault. I kind of dug myself into a hole by committing to it right at the beginning, and I'd forgotten just how long that last segment was from his writing. So I don't think I had any other option but to French my way out of it. but let's take a break and hit our sponsor real quick, and we will get back into Guy's take on this piece. For many of us in our own journeys, and particularly after finding Bitcoin, it becomes very clear how much school either never taught us or how many of those things were just wrong. That is where Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom comes in. There are so many great teachers in this set of courses, and monthly live sessions even, and forums to learn with others in the community. The number of courses here is just crazy, and they are still adding more. You can learn the truth of U.S. and Western history, about the history of political and economic thought over thousands of years, take a class on logic that teaches you how to think rather than what to think, and my personal favorite, a class that goes through the entirety of the traditional economics textbook, teaches it, and then explains where it is misleading or outright wrong, and exactly why. Liberty Classroom is the best place to learn the economics and history that public school never taught you, or that fed you nonsense about. Go to guyswan.com/liberty, and you will also help support this show. I've been a consumer of Liberty Classroom for a long time, and I know you guys will love it too. So Guy Swan, and that's Swan with two N's, guyswan.com/liberty. So something Eric does in this piece that I think is really interesting and really kind of informs the rest of this article, and actually a lot of what is written on cryptosovereign.org. And a lot of the cypherpunk philosophy, kind of the ideology that led to this and the thinking that kind of informs how powerful cryptography is the crypto anarchist perspective right here. Like, this is really kind of hitting at the fundamental perspective kind of how these tools are seen, but establishing as a baseline that crypto was a weapon of war. And that it was first a weapon of war, like that's where it was born out of. And I like the comparison that he makes to the nuclear bomb. And this is actually something that I think is kind of glossed over kind of from a historical perspective. I don't think kind of the cyberpunk community glossed over it at all, but that one of the most pivotal power dynamics in World War II was not merely the nuclear bomb. Like, yes, the invention of nukes was insanely instrumental in dealing kind of the final blow, so to speak. But any kind of study of history and the war, you see that the U.S. had actually already won the war. They were on the back end of this, right? Like, we were coming down the hill when it came to that war. And one of the more fascinating stories of this era, in my opinion, was of breaking the German encryption scheme. Like, this, I think, was really what turned the war, was the breaking of their cryptographic tool, their ability to have communications that the U.S. Army could not read. This is the story of the Enigma machine and then of Alan Turing, right? Of the creation of the very first computer. And this is something that Eric hits in this piece, was that, you know, like, this was why computers were born, to be a pushback in the power dynamic of cryptography. Like, one of the early, like, really excellent ciphers, cryptographic systems, was the Enigma machine. Like, this was a breakthrough for their system, for their ability to have private communications and to defend, again, as a weapon of war. When it was broken, when Alan Turing was tasked with this, you know, that before they used code breakers, you know, they literally manually would try to do this, and computers just changed the game. And this was essentially the birth of the first computer. Alan Turing was given this task and had developed a wholly unique way of breaking it by creating this huge structure of switches that would essentially test. It was a brute force hack. It was a brute force. That's what it was. And it essentially tested all of it until it, like, had a common set of patterns. Like, it would actually recognize certain patterns that it would look for. I don't want to spoil kind of what it was that uncovered, like, that finally kind of allowed them to look for a particular pattern that allowed them to break the Enigma machine. And every time any codes were updated or whatever, that they could break it, like, almost immediately afterward. But you should watch The Imitation Game, which is the story of Alan Turing. It's a fascinating movie, and I don't know to exactly what degree it's historically accurate, but all the big pieces were things that I had heard and or read elsewhere. So I guess it's, you know, roughly accurate, but it's a fascinating story. Anyway, it's a good ass movie. Just watch it. Another perspective or another thing that he lays out here from Foucault's kind of seminal work here that he's working off of is that the state and the law are a codification of a set of power relations. So this is essentially a way to encode a form of legitimacy. This is how we have to relate to each other. And the fact that we have this common code is how a society can be established. This is how a civilization can be established. Because if we don't have the same code for how to relate with one another, then we don't have a foundation to work from. Trying to make an agreement when the inputs of the agreement are not even defined as the same becomes an incredibly difficult thing to do, particularly when these contracts or some sort of business relationship needs to be enforced, in a sense, in the form of violence. Like, that's the legal system. And a revolution necessitates the fact that it is a recodification of those same relations. So it means that either the old system has become corrupted, or that codification simply isn't actually true. Like, it just becomes, as the kind of crux of this article and a lot of the theme of Eric's blog here, cryptosovereign.org, is that truth, not authority, creates legitimacy. That is the reality of cryptography, that it is about who has the right key, who has the valid signature. And cryptography allows that and essentially immunizes against any potential violation of that, because it makes any other, there's no alternative, essentially. You either have the key or you don't. And that essentially keeps authority in check, because the authority cannot, it's not because of the authority that you have key, like you have the key. It's because you have the key that you have authority. And it's flipping this on its head. Whereas the current power dynamics, when you think about the state or you think about the law, it is authority first, and then subsequently legitimacy is derived from that. But that's why legitimacy and that authority can be so easily corrupted, because it's circular. It's not about truth. It's not about the actual like owner or the actual history of the event. It's about the authority. So the authority gets to decide itself what the legitimacy is. And that's, you know, it's just a recipe for corruption. There's kind of no other way around that. It's, you know, it might work in the short term, but in the long term, humans are fallible. End of story. It's either by mistake or slow growing to like an abuse. But it just kind of necessarily has to be corrupted. The incentives are such that there's no other end result to it. And I think that's why society just kind of goes through this constant process of creating a new civilization and a new norm, essentially. And then it grows and grows. And the more successful it is, the more of the incentive to abuse it and corrupt it. And as we have these systems where the codification is, in fact, based on a system of authority, the easier it is to corrupt. And then the bigger it is, the more corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. Like, and it just happens until eventual collapse. And, you know, this is the tale of history. This is over and over and over again. It's got 1,000 different names and 1,000 different societies and 1,000 different locations, but it's the same story. And this is where the power of cryptography has been recognized by cypherpunks for a long time. Like, from the beginning of cypherpunk, take that back, from the beginning of kind of the study of cryptography, this is something that there was a seed laid, and it really kind of grew into this philosophy, because there is a fundamental, powerful truth in cryptography. And the quote-unquote ciphernet, as he refers to it here, but in my opinion, like, Bitcoin is a, you know, is that, in a sense. It's a functioning system of property rights here. So we'll just kind of use this as our hedge, like, irregardless of what else we can do with the ciphernet. Maybe we'll, you know, muse on that in just a minute. But that Bitcoin is a replacement of a violently enforced power structure for legal property rights. So it is the replacement system. It's a fundamentally different codification of that same relation of power, except that private keys, who owns the keys, so not your keys, not your coins, the owner of the keys are, like, that is the adjudication, that is the rightful owner. Whoever is the true holder of those keys, regardless of who it is or where they are or what the authority is, it just doesn't matter. There is no other alternative system that can shake that or contest it or has any meaning whatsoever. If you don't have a valid signature, end of story. Like, it is truth rather than authority that creates the legitimacy within the system. And that legitimacy, quote unquote, is a system of property rights. Who owns the Bitcoin and who can move it? Who can then give it to somebody else or exchange it with somebody else? Now, there's a lot that can be extended from this. And, you know, I still think it's possible that as every device becomes quote unquote smart, you know, we kind of have two paths that we could take there, is that everything becomes a spying device or everything becomes wholly our device. And I actually think the creation of something like Bitcoin and a kind of a system of quote unquote crypto hardware, is actually pivotal, like absolutely crucial to establishing some highly robust and widely used kind of, what would you call it, like a private key management DNA for a new economy, you know, a quote unquote cipher net that is the dominant economy. But with that, because of Bitcoin, because of the incentive of Bitcoin, potentially to actually drive that. If we have hyper-Bitcoinization, I think that's a real possibility. And you have these crazy potentiality, like potential hardware devices like Start9's Embassy, and have your own node, or potentially have a router that is your own set of keys, and that we have hardware keys. Like, look at the incentives that this creates. Like, I would never have thought of, like, I'm going to buy, I would spend $100 on a device that holds like my passwords or something for like my social media accounts. I never would have done that. That it didn't make any sense. It seems like a stretch. But then when you're holding real value in this, and when you understand, and when you lose some Bitcoin because you didn't do that, or you were stupid, or you got hacked in your, you know, freaking email address or something, you begin to see the value there. And suddenly shelling out $80, $150 on like a really good key management system is like a no-brainer. And those are really strong incentives. And you see that because, I mean, we go hella nerdy about a bunch of hardware wallets in this thing. I mean, I've got freaking 12 of the things just to play with them. And yeah, I know I'm a bit of an outlier. Like, I have a podcast and this is all I do every day. But also, people who are just dipping their toes in the water, I tell them to get hardware wallets, and they do. Anybody who has any substantial amount of Bitcoin that is in and around me, tech or not, has a hardware wallet. They do. And it, either I gave it to them as a present, or they bought it because I was like, no, you just got to do this. And they get it. You inform them for just an hour or two, and they're like, holy crap, because it's very easy to explain the difference between holding your own keys. If this is an irreversible system, yeah, you're screwed if somebody else has it. This is deeply embedded in the culture. Not your keys, not your coins. That's one of the first damn rules you hear when you get to this space. But what's cool is having that sort of DNA in the economy to essentially start to lay the groundwork where everybody is expected to have some sort of a key management device, the ability to extend that to where, I mean, you could essentially create unstealable hardware. And this is an idea that's been around for a long time, but essentially has never been able to get past the bootstrapping phase, because you can't force somebody to, or it doesn't make sense for somebody to have to buy other products to have a product. When you start to simplify these things and you have these incredibly like thought of or as default, like these very high security sort of systems, and all the perspective is around keeping the security but making these things as user-friendly as possible, you can begin to have a system where you can have smart hardware that is explicitly about making the hardware unusable without the valid keys. And I don't mean like, oh, you punch in the same password every time you turn on your TV or something like that. Again, user-friendly here. But essentially where a valid key can be used to brick a device without the exchange of it, that you could build into the hardware, and for, you know, these days, dirt cheap. Dirt cheap. You can get a hell of a computer. Those Raspberry Pi 4 Pluses or whatever the hell they are, they're serious little devices. You can do a lot with them. And this is only going to get cheaper. This is only going to get easier. And the open source hardware environment is expanding pretty rapidly. So the ability to have a kill switch in your device that only you could cut on or cut off, or only you could hand over to another key, could disincentivize so much theft. And this could simultaneously be used against the government, or as a defensive measure against a government, against a bad law. And same with kind of Bitcoin in general, is that if you don't hand over your key, they still don't have the authority. I mean, obviously, if they know who you are and they can come after you, but you are the bridge. It's the human is simply a bridge between the two systems. The systems themselves have nothing to do with each other. They are inherently separate. Bitcoin is inherently a replacement of the property rights system, and it is only the ability to protect or choose for yourself the risk and or the price or precautions that you are willing to pay or take in order to secure that bridge. But nonetheless, still, that's the only way in. That's the only way in. It's to get the key. And what's funny is that digital, I think it's maybe because, like, you know, like you're in the hacker environment, all you hear is about like awful vulnerabilities and the massive security holes and everything, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, I mean, hell, you know, listen to Security Now and you just think there's no way that any of this could ever work. But then somehow the internet is still here first thing in the morning. You go look and it works, shockingly. We've actually kind of already begun to see the effects of this sort of thing. So like, for instance, I was reading not too long ago about key fobs on cars and electronic door locks. Like, now a skilled hacker, somebody who with a dedicated attacker could pretty easily get access. Like, it's not like super hard to hack into some of these systems. Some of them are pretty good, but despite seemingly kind of from the you know, cryptographic perspective of like, oh, you could get into this, they've had dramatic effects on the stealing of cars. Just the introduction of key fobs has had a phenomenal decline in car theft since their introduction. And maybe that's it's a knowledge barrier, but I don't think so. I think it's a degree of, or I guess the lack of ubiquity in essentially the theft mechanism. But then to have, you know, to go that one step further with some sort of key management device or hardware wallets or something like that, and to, you know, attach the ability to start your car to something like that. I mean, you know, like there is some pretty profound shifts in society that you can get when you start to, when you are able to bootstrap an infrastructure like that, which Bitcoin is the ultimate incentive for. Cryptographic money is that very system to bootstrap that sort of security DNA, which we have not had up until now. But back to the article. So there's a perspective in this that I'm a little unsure about. Like, it's very, very cyberpunk to like think of it this way, I think. Or at least I would probably consider it that. And also it's like deeply libertarian, in that like peace under a system of authority is essentially a different state of war. Now, I think this is a very valuable perspective. I think this is a pretty amazing way to envision or kind of a frame to look through the lens of cryptography and look through to like look to see Bitcoin. You know, like I think this is a really potent image that is seen when you use that as the way to be able to weigh the possible outcomes of a system of independent stateless property rights, of independent stateless money. But there's something about the simplistic language of this that, you know, like war is just endless and ubiquitous, that I think is a step too far. There's a degree of truth in that all power structures are a form of master and subjugation sort of thing. That we can all, and we can obviously always get into the taxation is theft stuff. I totally agree with that, but I think there is still something to be said about some degree of a spectrum in power and how far it can be expended by those in power. So the power structure does, regardless of what, how surely someone is subjugated in a partial way, it does allow a baseline of the ability to contest it. Particularly in the short and medium term, like as soon as you start to extend these things out over centuries, you realize where the incentive structure lies and where the end result lies. But it's not as if people in power can always and forever do anything that they want and get away with it, because essentially there are lines drawn in where that power exists and where the authority lies. The problem is that, you know, just kind of laid out in this same perspective here, is that the authority is the ultimate arbiter as to where that line is. So when they start to get crossed, like I said, in the short to medium term, there is pushback and there is basically a way to point at the line and show who exactly it was that stepped over it. But the problem is that the system that incentivized the abuse of it, the very person who stepped over the line, then gets to arbitrate on really did they step over the line? And this is where the line gets incrementally pushed, just a little bit further, just a little bit further, just a little bit further. And slowly, because of the nature, again, back to the foundation of it, because the authority is the source of legitimacy, the only end result is increased corruption, pushing the line ever, ever closer into a cage around those subjugated, around the citizens. And particularly when, you know, your foundation is taxation, it is taxation is theft. It is a degree of subjugation. And it's basically like the state saying, oh, I'm only going to make you a slave for this portion. And then any barrier to that or any system set up around that is little more than a way to slow down the encroachment and expanding of this. But the incentives are all there for it to basically grow out of control. And like I say, only short and medium term really matters. In the long term, it's the same story. Grows, bloats, corrupts, abuses, collapses. And this is where Bitcoin truly, truly is a shocking shift in what it means for that. Like I said before, it completely and genuinely lies outside of that state, sovereign, legal apparatus. If you can keep your key secret, or even better, your identity and physical location along with that, there is little to be done. And since the bridge between that is the individual, then you can already see the only consequent, the only result that they can do, or the only route that they can take to fight it. The one war against this is the same whack-a-mole game that was played against BitTorrent. But just the reality that this is the new relationship, I think only informs how futile the fight is. That the eventual outcome is necessarily what BitTorrent did to the media giants. I mean, this isn't based on, you know, how much capital they have or how many resources they have. If the trend is toward greater cryptographic property and towards systems just like this, and for Bitcoin to continue to grow, which as a black hole to suck up value, there are very little incentives that are so strong as to make Bitcoin grow. It doesn't really matter if it takes 100 years or 10 years to expend the resources and, of course, the legitimacy, like the trust of the state system. It kind of seems like an inevitable outcome if the dynamics continue to shift in that direction. No, the whack-a-mole game gets exponentially more and more expensive as time goes on, and the dynamic is simply could not be clearer, is that the cost will go up and the benefit will continue to decline. That the reward from violence won't scale anymore. And this is the cypherpunk-like perspective. This is that fundamental change in how the state relates to the individual. And this is the sovereign individual thesis about how it is that these massive structures of violent codification of relationships necessarily must collapse. That it is a matter of time. Still might take a century. Like, we don't really know how quickly, we don't know how much the pushback will be. I guess technically we could easily go in the wrong direction too. We kind of have a very crucial decisions to make in this current shift, like during this transition. And I don't, you know, it's very possible that we could not go in that direction. I hope and truly think and at least feel that we could go in that direction, and that at least this community and the culture around Bitcoin is pushing ever harder in that direction. And we're building those tools. I see it every day. But that certainly doesn't mean that that will be the outcome just because it exists. But I don't think there is a tool as powerful as Bitcoin in moving us yet again further in that direction. Again, I think kind of the whole libertarian community, the, the fact that anybody in kind of that mindset is ignoring Bitcoin is deeply misguided. I think it is without a doubt the most powerful and potent tool for that future as we have at all. Going back to yesterday, well, not yesterday's anymore. Sorry, this episode took me so long to get out. It's been a crazy weekend, but the last episode, the Guys Take episode that we had, like showing just how much they might push back, there could not be a better time to take advantage of. Get a hardware wallet, withdraw your coins, hold your keys, learn how to do that. Watch the thousands of videos on YouTube. Please feel free to DM me, ask me any questions, but if you can withdraw and you can hold your own keys and you can get a hardware wallet and you have any substantial amount of money in Bitcoin, and remember, a small amount of money can turn into a substantial amount in one very short bull run. So, you know, think about where we're going to be in a year as well, not just where we are today. Treat it like it's 10 times the amount of money you have and secure your keys. Buy your hardware wallet, learn how to use it. And like I said, I am always here. Just ask me a question. I have so many people who will shoot me up a message and be like, I'm so sorry to ask this and I'm so sorry to bother you. Don't be sorry. Just ask. This is what I do. Let me know. Hit me up on Twitter at TheCryptoEconomy or at Bitcoin Audible. Both of those tags will get you straight to my inbox. And I will help in any way I can to get us to that future where it is truth rather than authority that is the source of legitimacy, that is the source of rights and property in the Bitcoin and hopefully some beautiful CypherNet system built by cypherpunks. It's kind of crazy looking back 14 or 15 years that we're here, because, you know, it was increasingly looking less and less viable. It was looking more and more sad as time went on that the cypherpunk vision of the internet actually wasn't going to be our future, that we were moving in the wrong direction rather than the right. And kind of looking back from that perspective and then looking forward and seeing where we are, it's almost magical that we are where we are. So we have the right idea. We are going in the right direction. While all the world is, you know, a train wreck going in the wrong, but that's why we got to stay focused. That's why we've got to learn. That's why we've got to hold our own keys. And, you know, we got to learn. We got to learn. We got to teach. We got to tell people about it. That's the goal here, to bring back individual responsibility, sovereignty, and individual rights. This is ultimately a quest to create new systems, new codification of human liberty and rights in the world. And that fundamentally starts with money. All right. We will close it out. I want to actually share something that is really, really cool. This is I think I mentioned it early on, was that there's a new feature dropped from Hexa Wallet. And this is really neat because it gives a web front end for the ability to send like donations, essentially, and it's a donations account. So you've got, like I said, in the wallet, you've got your checking account, your savings account, and your donations account now. So that's the new thing, but it literally lets you set up a web front end so that you can just have addresses generated every time somebody comes, and you can accept donations. So this is just kind of a really cool thing that, you know, would be great for like a certain project or obviously a podcast or content creator, something like that. So I immediately was like, oh, I'm jumping right the hell on this thing and set mine up. And if you want to see what it looks like and you want to, I'll have the link in the article so you can actually read how it works, because there's a really little clever system that they've got to kind of keep privacy and make it so that you're not exposing anything, but then allow them to essentially put up a web front end for you. But if you go to GuySwan, that's Swan with two N's, .com/donate, you'll just get to see the front end just so you can see what it's like to donate to my mobile wallet. And of course, if you want to donate to the show, feel free to donate in the show. I love it. Thank you. but it's just a really cool little feature. So if you haven't used Hexa Wallet yet, check them out at hexawallet.io. And if you want to see again what it looks like to have that donations address or donations account, go to guyswan.com/donate. And a huge thanks again to those guys for supporting Bitcoin Audible. All right, we will close this out. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. What a crazy, crazy piece by Eric Kaysen. This blog always just has some really, really cool stuff to dig into. And I love that hardcore cypherpunk perspective because, you know, these are really the things at the core of what this technology is and does. And like I've said so many times before, it is one of the most powerful forces we have for a better and brighter future. And it is our duty to learn all about it and secure our place on the other side. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.